the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. No doubt you've heard about the comments made by Illinois Senator Barack Obama in the midst of his candidacy for the 2008 Democratic presidential nomination, speaking to a fundraiser, closed door, in San Francisco a week ago. This is what he had to say. He was talking about the issue of people in Pennsylvania in particular, and economic and cultural realities tied to their perception of what's going on. And then he said this, listen to this. He said, and it's not surprising then they get bitter. They cling to guns or religion or antipathy to people who aren't like them or anti-immigrant sentiment or anti-trade sentiment as a way to explain their frustrations, end quote. Now, you can almost miss that. As a matter of fact, the first time I heard it, I missed some of it. But listen to it again. He says, and it's not surprising then they get bitter. They cling to guns or religion or antipathy to people who aren't like them or anti-immigrant sentiment or anti-trade sentiment as a way to explain their frustrations, end quote. Well, this has been all over the headlines. It has been the fodder for conversation and controversy on the Talking Head programs. The cable news networks are going crazy about it, and New York Senator Hillary Clinton has been making hay out of this, suggesting that it demonstrates that Senator Obama is simply elitist and out of touch. Well, the nation's talking about this because it gets right to some of the most central issues of how we are to understand what it means for a candidate to make certain statements and what it reveals concerning their worldview. The question today is not whether people actually turn to religion or guns or anti-immigrant sentiment because they're bitter. The question is, how does something like this reveal what's really going on in the worldview of a candidate? Now, what Senator Clinton right now is trying to argue to the people of Pennsylvania is, look, this tells you that Barack Obama is just not like you. He thinks that you carry guns and that you hold your positions and indeed you practice your faith because you're bitter about bad economic conditions. Now, whether or not you have any interest in who wins the Democratic presidential nomination, we all have a stake in trying to interpret comments like this and trying to figure out what they mean. That's going to be the topic for our conversation today on the Albert Mohler Program. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. When we come back, we're also going to be listening to some of what the candidates had to say in a forum televised last night from Pennsylvania on faith. And we're going to hear Democratic presidential candidates talking about what, so far as I know, they've never really been asked about in this way before. You're going to hear Hillary Rodham Clinton ask about the problem of evil and suffering, and Barack Obama ask a question about creation and evolution. We'll get to that in just a moment. First, to review some issues in the news, at my website at albertmohler.com, I posted a very important article overnight entitled Newsweek Discovers the Divorce Generation. It's very interesting. Newsweek is really on something of a string of very significant cover stories. They had the look inside the womb, looking at the issue of surrogate motherhood just recently, and now David J. Jefferson is writing an article about the divorce generation. He is a member of the 1982 graduating class at Grant High School in California's sprawling San Fernando Valley. The cover story is entitled Splitsville, The Divorce Generation Grows Up. In it, Mr. Jefferson went back to his classmates and started asking about the impact of divorce. We'll be looking at this more closely in a subsequent program, but you need to hear this. He says this, and you think about words that should really reach the heart and reach the head on the issue of divorce. Listen to this. He said, in our parents' generation, marriage was still the most powerful social force. In ours, it was divorce. My 44-year-old classmates and I have watched divorce morph from something shocking, even shameful, into a routine fact of American life. In other words, he's saying, as a member of the class of 1982, he was a member of the first big divorce generation. Now, in 1969, he entered kindergarten. That is, he notes, the very year that Governor Ronald Reagan, then the governor of California, himself divorced once himself, he signed California's no-fault law. And, of course, that opened the door. This is what David Jefferson has to say. He says, not since Henry VIII's breakup with the Pope has divorce received such a boost, By the time my friends and I entered our senior year at Ulysses S. Grant High School, divorce rates had soared to their highest level ever, with 5.3 per 1,000 people getting divorced each year, more than double the rate in the 1950s. Just as we were old enough to wed, experts were predicting that nearly one in two marriages would end in divorce. Now, I would suggest that you find this article at Newsweek. You can go to my website at albertmiller.com. You can follow the link and read David Jefferson's article there at Newsweek. You might want to pick it up in your newsstand. Just consider the fact that these news magazines often tell us a great deal about the culture. When you put the three news magazines together, Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, you are putting together three of the most expensive pieces of real estate in American media. You're talking about cover stories that are intended to send a cultural signal. Something significant is taking place when Newsweek decides to put a story like this on the front, because the story is pretty bracing. It's pretty candid. David Jefferson writes, "Around our tract homes, divorce was a constant intruder in the San Fernando Valley of my youth." He says, even though he grew up just a few blocks from the set of the Brady Bunch, the similarity between that TV family's tract rancher and the ones where my friends and I lived pretty much ended at the front door. The real valley of the 1970s, in that valley, families weren't coming together, they were coming apart. We were the divorce generation, latchkey kids raised with after-school specials about broken families and Kramer versus Kramer, the 1979 Best Picture winner that left kids worrying that their parents would be the next to divorce. Now, very interestingly, he tracks some of the classmates he had from the class of 1982 and documents their impressions now about their divorces. It's really sad stuff. They talk about their experience, the shame. Some of these kids hid the divorces of their parents, even from their friends whose parents had divorced, because they just couldn't handle even talking about it. They talked about the fact they were latchkey kids. Elise Oliver writes about the fact that she was growing up too fast, taking care of herself with her little sister cooking dinner. She says this, at the age of 9, she was smoking. At 13, she was having sex. Now listen to this. This will just shock, I think, a lot of parents. My boyfriend at the time went up to my mom and said, "Hey, we want to have sex, so can you put her on the pill?" Her mother agreed. I found one of the saddest accounts to be from a man who, at the time of his father's second divorce, was 15 years old. He had to serve as a 15-year-old divorce counselor for his father. Listen to this. The article explains, quote, "When my father's second marriage collapsed, I was a 15-year-old high school freshman who was forced to become a crisis counselor, sitting in the front seat of his car for endless hours, listening to him and trying to keep him from completely breaking down." David Jefferson writes, he may have been helping his dad, but Chris was doing damage to himself, encasing his own emotions in a dispassionate shell. Quote, "That outward calm expression has led me to be labeled as cold and uninspiring and has at times hampered my ability to succeed both in my professional and personal life," says Chris. You start looking at that and you realize, you know, there's something wrong in a world in which a 15-year-old boy is put in the position of counseling his father through his father's second divorce. There's just something deeply heartbreaking and tragic about that. It turns out that the children of divorce have a lot to say. You can find it in the Newsweek article, and you'll find a mixed bag of their own perception of a lot of these issues. But I guarantee you'll find it fascinating. And if nothing else, it is a reminder of the cost of divorce, not just in the immediate. These kids talk about that in terms of all the custody arrangements, step-parent concerns, and all the rest. But in the long term, as David Jefferson suggests, that divorce can become like a genetic fault that is passed on from one generation to another. On the other hand, there were some of the children of divorce who, witnessing what it did to their parents and to themselves, said that when they got married, they would stay married, and some of them are. Well, parents have a lot of concerns these days. The Boston Globe is out with a story that says that a lot of parents are rebelling on the amount of time their children spend text messaging. AT&T may be leading the way for some cell phone providers in allowing parents to limit the total number, not just limit in terms of payment, but limit in terms of access, their teenager and young children, in terms of their access to text messages. AT&T has unveiled a program allowing parents for a $4.99 monthly fee to limit the number of messages and the amount of money their children spend on downloads. Also, parents can control the periods of time when the phone is used. The story opens up with a 12-year-old girl whose father has now required her to sign a cell phone usage contract. She lost the phone back in November when she sent her family's cell phone bill, $220 higher than usual. Now get this, with 1,022 extra calling minutes and more than 200 text messages. Specialists on this watching what's going on in adolescent culture among high school and college students, junior high, middle school students also, are suggesting that some of these students are running up 1,500, 1,600, 1,700 and more text messages. Well, folks, that takes some time. Not only that, it's an artificial means of communication. You're looking at a big change in adolescent culture here, and it's interesting that some parents are simply rebelling by saying, we want the child to have the cell phone, communication, and the safety that is available through that cellular technology, but we do not want them to live primarily cellular lives. A good warning to us all. We're going to come back to talk about the conversation last night with Senators Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton over the issue of faith and politics. And we'll be back with your calls in just a moment.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Well, one thing's for absolute certain, and that is that the 2008 race for the Democratic presidential nomination is far more interesting than anyone would have thought just a matter of some months ago. As a matter of fact, here we are into the late stages of the spring, and all of a sudden, a race that was supposedly going to be over in the New Hampshire primary is going strong and never stronger, perhaps, than over this past weekend with the exchanges between Senator Barack Obama and Senator Hillary Clinton over the issue of Senator Obama's comments. You got to watch these names on what took place in San Francisco at a fundraiser the previous Sunday. This is what Senator Obama had to say. He said, speaking of the situation of frustration, especially among voters who are experiencing hard economic times, he said, it's not surprising then they get bitter. They cling to guns or religion or antipathy to people who aren't like them or anti-immigrant sentiment or anti-trade sentiment as a way to explain their frustrations. Now, what must now frustrate Senator Obama is that so much is being made of these comments, which he thought were being made off the record or at least at a private meeting, but were recorded and hit the press late last week and certainly hit the headlines a matter over the weekend. My guest today is our good friend, Dr. Russ Moore, Dean of the School of Theology at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and guest host of this program, a keen observer of these things. Russ, what do you think of all this?
Well, I think there's really two interesting aspects of that. Number one is the firestorm about Barack Obama being a limousine liberal. You think about Hillary Clinton taking a swat at John Kerry and Al Gore, saying we've had other candidates who have been out of touch with average, ordinary people. The second thing is the way that Barack Obama seems to equate religion and personal faith with all of these political issues, holding guns and these other. It's just another socio-political niche that people fit in, and that's one of the reasons why I think there's been so much reaction from folks in Pennsylvania saying, clinging to my religion because I'm angry and bitter. But I think
or
really
anti-immigrant
reveals
sentiment. In other words, just looking at a political position and saying it's due to a socio-psychological pathology. Okay, let's talk about that for just a moment, because you mentioned, first of all, the elitist charge made by Senator Clinton. And there has to be a good deal of irony in that. I mean, after all, their tax returns were released just the previous week, over $100 million in the past 7 years. But let's give Bill Clinton political credit. The man knew how to play a populist game.
He did, although he made almost the exact same statement in his autobiography, My Life. It's just that Bill Clinton is able to word it in such a way that it doesn't strike you as such an elitist tone.
Well, and frankly, but he was smart enough to make that statement after 8 years in the
exactly
White House,
right.
Not before.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. But, of course, he always knew, I think, that he would have one of his family members running for office. But the charge that there's an elitist type of dismissal of ordinary Americans, that goes back a long way. That goes back to the silent majority days in the 1960s. There's always been a sense of, do we have liberals in the country who are out of touch with what goes on with working people?
You know, this reminds me of Peter Berger, the perhaps most famous sociologist of religion in the United States. And he talked about a qualitative study made across cultures of those that were most religious, those that were least religious. Mm-hmm. And just looking at religiosity as some kind of index, he said that America, let's start out with the least religious nation, he said, was Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
And the most religious nation, he said, was India.
Mm-hmm.
And then looking at the United States, he said, we have a nation of Indians ruled over by an elite of Swedes.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the cultural elite in the United States is about as secular as is the larger culture in Europe. But they're the anomaly. That was Dr. Berger's point. The elites are really the ones who are out of touch with mainstream America. And you start looking at red state, blue state issues. You start looking at some of the comments that are made. And I'll tell you, Russ, what I think is most damaging to Barack Obama about this statement is he believes it. It in other words, it's perfectly consonant with a good many of the other positions he holds.
Well, and it also fits right in with the controversy he just came out of over Jeremiah Wright.
Right.
You're not able to see religion as functioning in any way other than propping up some social or political agenda, and can't really understand why somebody would hold to their faith in a way different from the way they think about immigration or guns.
Well, you know, we would not presume for a moment to be able to read Barack Obama's heart. But last night in a forum in Pennsylvania, he spoke in particular some of the issues related to his own faith, as did Senator Clinton. And it was a very interesting event, as a matter of fact. And I want us to hear Obama first, as, for instance, he was talking about the whole issue of his faith and how it relates. And he was trying to explain that comment that he made. Guys, run clip 10.
So what I was referring to was in no way demeaning a faith that I myself embrace. What I was saying is that when economic hardship hits in these communities, what people have is they've got family, they've got their faith, they've got the traditions that have been passed on to them from generation to generation. Those aren't bad things. That's what they have left. And unfortunately, what people have become bitter about, and oftentimes have told me about as I traveled through not just Pennsylvania, but I was referring to states all across the Midwest, including my home state, is any confidence that the government is listening to them. They don't think that government's listening to them.
That was Senator Barack Obama last night at what was called the Compassion Forum at Messiah College in Grantham, Pennsylvania. You know, Russ, when I hear him talking that way, I hear of Thomas Frank. I hear the refrain of Thomas Frank in his book, mm-hmm. What's Wrong with Kansas?
Yeah.
You remember he wrote this book saying, hey, Kansas keeps voting Republican and they're voting against their own interests. They don't know they're supposed to be bitter.
They've been duped.
That's right. Now, isn't Barack Obama basically saying to the people of Pennsylvania, if you're not bitter, you don't get it.
That's
you should
exactly
be.
That's right. And you have this illusion of all of these things that you value, and they're really about the fact that you're angry and you're mad. And also, at the same time, this kind of defense, it sounds to me like the old Jerry Seinfeld routine. Not that there's anything wrong with that. You all are clinging to your religion. But that, I mean, I'm not saying that's anything bad. When obviously it is, when you're talking in the context of anti-immigration and bitterness and hostility, it's obvious that he was making a judgment about these things.
Let's listen to Senator Clinton speaking about Senator Obama's comments. This is last night.
You know, the Democratic Party, to be very blunt about it, has been viewed as a party that didn't understand and respect the values and the way of life of so many of our fellow Americans. And I think it's important that we make clear that we believe people are people of faith because it is part of their whole being. It is what gives them meaning in life through good times and bad times. It is there as a spur, an anchor to center one in the storms, but also to guide one forward in the day-to-day living that is part of everyone's journey.
Then speaking directly of Senator Obama's comments, she had this to say.
Someone goes to a closed-door fundraiser in San Francisco and makes comments that do seem elitist, out of touch, and frankly patronizing. That has nothing to do with him being a good man or a man of faith. We had two very good men and men of faith run for president in 2000 and 2004. But large segments of the electorate concluded that they did not really understand or relate to or frankly respect their ways of life.
You know, when you are running for president of the United States, every word you say becomes parsed, interpreted, sometimes corrupted and manipulated. In this case, I think Senator Clinton gave as much information here and as much fodder for conversation as the comment to which she was responding from Senator Obama. When we come back, we'll be looking at this and trying to figure out who the elitist is and whether it matters. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Call us with your comment or your analysis of this at 877-893-TALK. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. My guest today is Dr. Russ Moore, and we're having a great conversation about what was really the raging conversation over the weekend, having to do with comments made the previous Sunday by Illinois Senator Barack Obama. And those comments, once reported late last week in the press, became something of a firestorm, and it led right into what was known as the Compassion Forum held last night, in which both Senator Obama and Senator Hillary Clinton of New York were responding to questions related to their faith and their political candidacy. Let's go back, Dr. Moore, to comments that were made by Senator Clinton last night. She said that the Democratic Party's had a challenge convincing Americans that they really understand who Americans are and sympathize with their true beliefs.
Yeah, sure they do. Think about Teresa Hines Carey walking into Wendy's and asking what chili is. Several commentators are pointing out you have had several candidates in the Democratic Party stream who seem to be out of touch. Republican Party did in 1992 when much was made of George W. Bush remarking about the new technology of the supermarket
scanner.
Yeah, that's right. So she's on to something there, but it's really remarkable to see that being said by the first lady of the vice president who was running in 2000, making
well,
that kind of
Well, let's
comment.
Make a couple of observations here. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversations. We're trying to think about this. Let's put it into context. By the time a candidate runs seriously for president of the United States, they have been living, Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal, they have been living in something of an unreal bubble of a politically charged world. Let's just say they haven't been worried about the things most Americans are worried about, because if they were worried about those things, they couldn't run for president.
Yes, but what I think Hillary Clinton is getting at is that when you've got clever marketing, though, you can make that candidate appear to be a regular guy. Or even beyond that, you can have a president who is himself very elite, but who seems to at least understand the way people live. Ronald Reagan or Franklin Delano Roosevelt, for that matter.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it has to do with skill, too. And as a matter of fact, yesterday, one of the comments made about Senator Obama repeatedly on the Sunday news programs was that he has let out some very unscripted comments that have tended to play up this whole elitist personality. For instance, George Will, time and time again, comes to the fact that in Iowa, he was using as his illustration of an agricultural crisis the fact that there's no arugula in the Whole Foods market.
Yeah, that's right.
And
that's
as
right.
George Will points out, there's not even a Whole Foods market in the entire state of Iowa.
Yeah, that's right. That goes back to Michael Dukakis, remember, telling the farmers in Iowa, you ought to plant romaine lettuce. And what is romaine lettuce? All that these farmers know about is the crops that they already have. She's on to something here in which she's trying to exploit a sense that Senator Obama is dismissing of ordinary, regular people. You see that also with the image of his bowling in Philadelphia, in which you have Pennsylvania working-class voters saying the man does not know how to bowl. That's a big issue in a market-driven advertising age when candidates are sized up as to whether or not they're the people you want to have a beer with.
Well, you know,
not that you'd want to have a beer with, but yeah, that folks would want to have a beer.
Thank you for that clarification, Dr. Moore. But, the other thing is there that I do know how to bowl.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't want to bowl in front of television cameras. There's an artificiality to this that just makes me so uncomfortable. And these guys, they're all, and again, this is not a partisan issue, Democrat, Republican.
Right.
I mean, I remember a picture I saw of John McCain, and he was supposedly fishing in the river behind his house. So just to level this out in terms of partisan politics, and I do fish, and he was supposedly fly fishing, but even in posing for the photograph, he didn't have a fly fishing rod in his hand. He had a rod and a reel.
That's right. That's right.
So, I mean, these things are so artificial. You look at it and you say, you know, somebody ought to tell these people, just admit we're elitists, but say the world will be safer in our hands. But you know that no one's going to vote for them if they say that.
Yeah, that's right, because you want to have a sense of comfort. You want your president to be your spiritual guide and your friend and all of these other factors.
Well, when it comes to the comment made by Senator Obama, let me tell you what my main concern is. My main concern is that it reveals not just about Senator Obama, but about a large portion of the elites in this country. And that would, by the way, include some conservative elites as well as liberal elites, would hold to the fact that they believe that religion, faith, their preferred word, is basically functional.
Yeah.
It's not really about knowing truths about an eternal God. It's really about what faith does for people. And interestingly enough, when you listen to the answers made at the Compassion Forum last night, both of the candidates basically responded with what faith means to them. There's an amazing lack of using the word God.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's not so much about beliefs, it's about the functionality of faith. And for an awful lot of people in this country, especially at the level of the elites, and again, conservative and liberal, you're going to find a lot of people who think it's basically functional. We'll talk more about that when we come back. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Miller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're looking at the controversy about Senator Barack Obama's comments made in San Francisco a little over a week ago now, where he made the statement that people tend to cling to religion and guns and anti-immigrant feeling and all the rest simply because they're frustrated or bitter. And this really set the stage for a very interesting confrontation here in the Democratic race between Senator Clinton and Senator Obama. We were listening in just the closing moments there to some of the things that Senator Clinton had to say. But we're also looking at the fact that this functional idea of religion is really pretty rampant among the elites. Let's go to Gail calling from Brookville, Ohio, listening on XM 170. Go ahead, Gail.
Yes, I thought it was interesting when you played the comments from Obama and Clinton, how expressive that was of their polarized positions about faith. Obama's position was faith, something you grab onto when you don't have anything else, it's your last hope. Whereas Clinton's position seemed to be more about faith being a guiding force. And those two positions said a lot to me about how active faith might be or might not be in their lives and is in their guidance as leaders.
Very interesting point, Gail. Clearly, you have two different forms of discourse here. Just to speak in terms of the rhetoric, you have two very different approaches. But you also, and I want to point this out, have two very different audiences. When Barack Obama was in San Francisco speaking at a fundraiser, he was speaking to his crowd. He was speaking to one of the places in America which is least religious, just in terms of the kind of survey data you have come back. The Pacific Northwest is the most secular part of the country, and San Francisco is one of the most secular metropolitan areas in the entire United States. And so he was speaking to an audience there. He wasn't speaking to a national audience. Honestly, I think if he were, he would have said it somewhat differently. But give Senator Clinton credit. She knew her audience when she was speaking. And again, we can't read the heart, but we're just looking at the words here. When we were last talking about the functional aspect of religion that's really behind this, it gets to the fact that among many in the elites who follow more of a sociological analysis of what it means for people to believe in God, they say it has to have a function. And, you know, Freud said it has to have a psychological function. And people like Emil Durkheim said it had to have a social function. And so what we see here are people who believe that it really doesn't matter what the faith is. And as a matter of fact, this word faith itself, presented as something of a noun, it's just like that these beliefs are coping mechanisms. And Russ, there are just an awful lot of people, within and without the political sphere, who hold to that kind of understanding.
They do. And you think about the backgrounds both of these candidates are coming from. Barack Obama is a community organizer who was using religion and faith and churches in order to build up the organizations he was seeking to work with. Hillary Clinton comes also out of a very social gospel Methodist context. She talks about the influence her youth minister had on her as a teenager in presenting to them a holistic picture of the gospel, but getting them ready for social activism, talking about Vietnam and all of these issues. It's kind of the reverse of what Jesus said when Jesus said, man does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. You see human beings first as economic beings, and faith kind of fits into that structure later on.
It was called the Compassion Forum last night, but the issue of abortion came up. And both candidates responded to the question about when life begins and how this plays out on the abortion issue. Guys, run clips 5 and 6 here where we hear Senator Clinton speak.
I believe that the potential for life begins at conception. I am a Methodist, as you know. My church has struggled with this issue. In fact, you can look at the Methodist Book of Discipline and see the contradiction and the challenge of trying to sort that very profound question out.
Okay, let's just stop there for a moment, because for sake of time, I can summarize what she had to say following, which is basically a pro-choice position. She says it's not only about a potential life, it's about the other lives involved, and therefore I've concluded after great, you know, concern and searching my own mind and heart over many years that our task should be in this pluralistic, diverse life of ours in this nation. She goes on to say individuals should be left to make this decision themselves. Let's listen to what Senator Barack Obama had to say about when life begins.
This is something that I have not, I think, come to a firm resolution on. I think it's very hard to know what that means. When life begins, is it when a cell separates? Is it when the soul stirs? So I don't presume to know the answer to that question. What I know, as I've said before, is that there is something extraordinarily powerful about potential life, and that that has a moral weight to it that we take into consideration when we're having these debates.
The question, of course, is how exactly they're supposedly taking this into consideration. And I want to go back to the fact, Russ, that both of the candidates qualified human life with the word potential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and both of them are learning from their teacher, which is Bill Clinton, who came up with a politically brilliant but I think devious phrase, safe, legal, and rare, to give people an opportunity to say, hey, I'm against abortion, but I think this ought to be legal and even funded. And if it ought to be rare, if you don't know whether or not this is a life, as Senator Obama just said, then why would you take the risk, even if it's just a possibility that these are human lives, of snuffing them out by the millions? That makes absolutely no sense, but it's crafty rhetoric.
It's crafty rhetoric, and it came up in exactly those words. Mm-hmm. In Senator Clinton's response. She said, and as some of you heard me discuss before, I think abortion should remain legal, but it needs to be safe and rare.
And again, it's the assumption that what is at issue here is simply an economic factor. So if you can just provide the kind of means that people have for effective birth control, as she would say, and all of these other factors, then you can limit this without taking into consideration what does it do to your view of human life and of innocence and protecting those who are vulnerable and most vulnerable. That's not even in the picture here.
You know, I think what is in the picture here, though, Russ, is when you look at this qualification of life as potential human life,
mm-hmm.
and then you hear Senator Obama say we have to take this into consideration, and as Senator Clinton says, we have to entrust individuals to make this profound decision. What you're saying is that this life is to be taken with serious thought. In other words, it's not don't have the abortion, it's you should really think about the fact that this is meaningful potential life.
But, you know, 2 weeks ago when Senator Clinton was talking about that young pregnant woman who died in the hospital in Ohio, she said we lost that young woman and her baby. And
yep.
So when it's a baby for political purposes, it's a baby for Senator Clinton. When it's not,
well,
it's
and you
else.
Also had just in recent days Senator Barack Obama saying that if his two daughters, if one of them were to get pregnant or was to have premarital sex, he didn't want them to be burdened with a baby.
Yeah, be punished.
Right. Fascinating discourse here. And when you're listening to political discourse, you always have to put it into context. You also have to realize that these are words offered under a great deal of pressure. And so we always have to give candidates an opportunity to expand upon what they really meant and to make corrections where necessary. But when we're talking about these comments here, the explanations are sometimes even stranger than the comment. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Russ, when you're looking at a political campaign like this and listening to political candidates, what do you tell people to listen for?
I want them to listen to what people are trying to get you to think. So in other words, you don't just say, well, I think they're lying, or I think they're saying some rhetoric that isn't true. What are they trying to do? What do they want you to believe? And that kind of gets back behind to see what constituencies they want to be playing to later on when they're elected.
There is a very interesting new book out entitled Ghosts in the White House,
mm-hmm.
and it's about the relationship between presidents and their ghostwriters, their speechwriters.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that becomes very evident the closer you get to the political sphere is how few of the words spoken by a candidate are actually the candidate's words. And that's the artificiality in this entire
yeah.
age of telegenic and digital politics, because most of these talking points have been vetted with marketing kind of analysis long before a candidate ever utters the words.
And heated committee meetings trying to craft exactly the right phrase is going to appeal to exactly the right constituency.
Yeah, and so I think it's very important that as we think about the Christian responsibility to vote, and this, again, is nonpartisan. This relates to people of every party and every political persuasion. Candidates are about a business of getting elected. And in order to do that, they have to craft a message that will attract the right kind of support. And interestingly, the accusation made by some of the insiders on the talk shows on Sunday, the Sunday news programs, was that this demonstrates that Senator Obama simply hasn't been coached well enough. And I found that a very, very interesting analysis, mm-hmm. Russ. In other words, it wasn't that this betrayed something about his heart or his soul that should concern Americans. It was just he wasn't adequately coached.
Yeah, and that's for the candidate who's supposed to be the authentic candidate of authentic change and relationality. That tells us something about where we are.
Well, you start looking at all this together, and it's just a reminder that the world of politics is a world of tremendous seduction and manipulation, and we should not be surprised that it takes hard work to really try to figure out who the person is. At the same time, the policy positions sometimes are easy to understand. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would suggest as we close this program today, is that as Christians think about the vote, let's not get as hung up on the personality and all of this that becomes the fodder for the headlines. The reality is that presidents are elected in order to execute policies, in order to provide national leadership on issues. And by the time we get to the two-party conventions, with the adoption of the two-party platforms, we're going to have a very clear distinction between those two candidates. As always, Russ Moore, great to have you today on the program. This has been the kind of discussion that at least ought to get a lot of us thinking about what we should be listening for and how we should be listening to what candidates have to say. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation, we're going to look at the impact of population control programs on this world experiment. We're going to see that when governments try to control populations, disaster often ensues. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.